Mr. Mann, Rail 9. You've arrived at Salerno. The landing had already gone on and gone in, hadn't it?
Yes, there was a beach had established.
What are your memories of the view that you were seeing for the very first time?
Well, in the harbour itself, there was still the convoys and that. We were being attacked by aircraft, even at that stage, German aircraft come. And they did actually attack the hospital ship that was in the Salerno Bay. From there, Salerno itself, from what I can remember, was a beach which was a slight gradient, but barbed wire and trucks through lined out with tape, which was a mine-free area, so you could get a shore like that. And then once we got onto the shore, we made our way to a theatre that was in Salerno.
Just before we get there, were the bodies still lying around? Were you seeing death for the first time?
No, the bodies had been cleared from the beach at that time. As I say, the bridge had been established, and it wasn't until about 2 or 3 miles into Salerno there. I just remember the Bay of Salerno as well before going ashore, while we were waiting to go. I remember looking up at a mountainside, and there was a white house there, which always stuck in my memory. And it was still there when we went back to Salerno just 2 or 3 years ago, and I pointed out to the white house. I explained to her there's a white house up there, which you see, and sure enough, it was still there. In Salerno itself, we got ashore, there were civilians there. They were, I suppose, really starving, because we were given a bit of a get-together meal of a tin that had been put into boiling water and boiled up, M&V, meat and veg. We all had one of these tins apiece, remember. And there was an old chap there, he was a stick and he was a bit crouched, and he had an empty tin in his hand, and he would take anything that you cared to put into it. Even if it was, I mean, some of these M&B tins, said of meat, had a great big lump of fat. But personally, I could never stick fat, and I can't even do it today's day. But he could put it into his tin, he was grateful for it. There was loads and loads of them. And another memory I have of there, we were in this theatre for the first night, because we weren't in range, really, of the small arms fire or anything like that. We're in this theatre this first night, and the next morning we just came out for fresh air, as it were, at the front, waiting to see what was going to happen. And an Italian woman came up, and from what I could understand, I mean, I couldn't speak Italian or anything like that, but made it understand that she'd had a daughter who had been taken by the Germans, and that if I come across her daughter going to Italy, you know, would I give her a sort of a message from her mother that she was asking there. And I still have, to this day, the photograph that she gave me of her and her daughter. Of course, I never did see her daughter. And it was only a short contact, but I only saw that once. And from...
Were you still with B Company?
No, the... I was MT company then, when we got in.
Dispatch riding, were you?
Dispatch, and I was driving 1500 weight as well. I was a bit of an all-rounder, as it were. Anything from that town, I'd even driven a Bren gun carrier. But as I say, after this first night we were on, and the names were called out, of which mine was one of them. 9 of us there were, and we were told that we were going to be posted to the auction books.
What was your response to that?
Well, the main was, well, when we left there at the time, I said, why aren't we going to the Durhams? But they said, because you've been posted to the auction books, and we had no recourse on that or anything. So from there, it was a case of go get our kit together, and we'll put on to lorries and take just a few miles out of Salerno and join the Oxen Books. There were some bivvy tents that had been put up for us, and I remember opening the flap of this bivvy tent and looking in there. I thought it looked like water because it was just the roof of the tent, and the hole was dug as a trench. And for other say, it just looked like water, but what it was a bit of moonlight shining down. It was straw laid in the bottom of the trench. So we got this, and I was paired off to the lad called Jack Stevenson.
Was he one of your nine? He was one of your nine, was he?
Yeah, nine. Jack Stevenson. I was paired off with him into this tent. And we talked between us, and we said, well, if we knew where the Durhams were, we'd be off and try to find them. But of course, we didn't have a clue. It's like dumping in a foreign country. You didn't know which left from your right. So, as I say, we'd arrived there in the night.
Where was the unit positioned in regard to the enemy at this point?
It was just before a place called Nola. From where we were to the actual front line, as near as I remember, would be about 3 miles, something like that. And the morning, when we were paraded with the Oxen Bucks, our first day with the course line, and they asked them, the nine of us, was there any drivers? Of course, Stevenson was, and I was. So we were both picked, and we were told, well, there's an anti-tank truck, which towed the lightweight cannon for anti-tank, and the 1500 weight. So Jack and me, we toss it, we'll take which of them would be nice. And we threw a coin up, it fell down. I was right with my guess, we had the tail, whatever it was. Oh, I said I would take the 1500 weight. And later in the day we moved off. Jack was in the anti-tank truck. It moved ahead of us. We followed on about 20 minutes or so later, and in the truck was the sergeant major, and we were the anti-tank section. And we got up, and the truck had pulled in to what was a bigger stator probably, and I thought, oh, that's Jack's truck, and there was sat and laid beside it. So we pulled up, and what had happened, they were wounded straight there to wake, the same day, and they'd just stopped. Shells had come over, and Jack got badly wounded in his leg. It was a blighty touch, not one got him back to blighty.
The sight of seeing your friend wounded by the side of the road, was that your first sign of injury?
That's right, from the enemy.
Do you recall your reaction to seeing him and the others?
Yes, I don't know how to explain it really, but whilst it made me think in one sense what could have been, I more or less accepted it. That was actually, if there was anything I could do naturally there, because they had money between themselves to put the dressing on, shell dressing, which everybody carried, of course. They would bandage up. And it was just a case then of waiting for the medics to pick them up. And I would say, this doctor asked me to take what personal belongings he had on him to, if I would send those back to England, which I did eventually.
What state was he in as you were talking to him after this injury?
He was talking. He was under that, but I would still say he was in a bit of a state of shock, because I just remember it was as white as snow, which was obvious. And but he was still talkative. I think he more or less accepted it as well. He hadn't panicked. But apparently, how it had happened, they just stopped beside him and got to the side of the truck. The truck was between them and the enemy, we couldn't see. And it's just unfortunate that this shell had come over and splintered and caught them. If it had been separated a bit, it maybe wouldn't have caught all of them. I think it was four of them.
You say you're in the anti-tank gun section, that's correct?
The anti-tank.
Yeah. What were you carrying in your truck?
In truck was ammunition. Mainly ammunition, you could say. And the person who rode with me was a Sergeant Major. Charlie Briggs, they called him. He was from Abingdon, near Oxford. Incidentally, he did hold a referee, football referee's certificate for First Division. Anyhow, but Charlie Briggs, we used to call him. And it was ammunition that we would carry on the truck. And basically some of the kit bags and that of the section.
Where was the anti-tank section in relation to the rest of the battalion as you moved forward?
I would say we're maybe about half a mile behind the, unless we were called up. If you were called up, well, it was a case of the trucks going as far forward as possible.
So it would be headquarter company, was it,
headquarter
that you attached
company,
to?
Yes. The anti-tanks, of course, they were also hand in hand with the mortar section, 2-inch mortar section, not heavy mortars. They were made up. One thing, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong in one sense, but we always got the impression, us lads from the Durhams, that we were North Country and the Oxenbucks were South Country. And just, yes, I got that was the impression that I got. But with Jack, of course, he was the one who was sitting most under the other seven. They were posted to platoons throughout the. So of course we're all split up there.
Did you settle in well with the South Country types?
Those that were more or less in immediate contact with. But some of the others, I don't know. I just got that impression. You know, that we were northerners and they were southerners. Well, that's it. We were in the auction box and we just had to stick to it. But I know from where Jack got wounded there, the next thing I can just remember is we moved up a bit and there was like a dike and an old farm, small farmhouse it was. We put this truck behind the farmhouse of trying to get a bit of cover. And from there, just not clear what happened. But I know we got shelled again in that position. And I jumped into this dike, which I didn't realise had as much water as what was in it. It was a bit sort of like kedge rows at the side of it and that. And of course, I lost my tin hat. And this was a position which was very close to the Riverwold terminal, and preparations were made from this position. Well, we're quite close to all the battalion now, we're quite close. Preparations were being made to cross the Riverwold terminal.
I forgot to ask you, what brigade and division were you in?
The Oxenbucks, they were the 56th London Division. The Black Cat was the shoulder water. And the brigade that the Oxenbucks was in was with the two battalions of the Queen's Regiment, 5th and 7th, 6th. And that was the 168 Brigade.
And yours was the 7th Battalion, wasn't it, Oxenbucks?
7th Battalion, yeah. And the Queen's 2nd, 5th and 2nd, 6th. There was, I think it was 167, 168 and 169 Brigades. In the division, but of course another thing was, I don't really know enough, but the 56th London Division came under the American 5th Army. It wasn't the 8th Army, and we were with the 5th Army anyway. All the towns were the Oxenbucks.
Who Who was commanding the your battalion?
Krugus. Colonel Krugus. Krugus, they called him.
What was he like?
He was a bit of a stricter, as most of the senior officers were and that. One thing, if you were in the line before you came out of the line, for instance, you have to shave. No matter how many days you've been, you need to shave while you're in the line. Well, before you come out of the line, you had to shave. And that didn't matter whether it was sunshine or whether it was snow and ice all around you, you still had to shave before you come out of the line.
Who was commanding the anti-tank section?
I can't just remember his name. It was a captain, but I doubt it's got his name. Charlie Briggs was a sergeant major, but just the officer was, I couldn't give you a name to of you. It'd be a fortune.
What was Charlie Briggs like?
Charlie Briggs, he was a southerner, but really got on very well with him, I must admit that. And it was a good sport, really. He wasn't the type of man who you would accept as a sergeant major. He wasn't one of these abrupt persons or anything like that. And even his language was a lot better than some of the other sergeant majors that had encountered in the service. There was the other two lads there. One was Hall, they called him, and another Richardson. And this Hall, he was only a small boot shop. And he used to get away with it. He used to call the sergeant major Charlie. That's the whole thing. The first sergeant major was at times saying, what do you think this is on me, sleeve? There's rank on that. But this little lad, Paul, he really got away with it, calling Charlie.
What weapon size gun did you have in the anti-tank section?
Well, as a driver there, the weapon they had at that time was a rifle. It was a Lee Enfield rifle then, not the old Ross, like I said, I was in training. Just a Lee Enfield rifle and bayonet.
And the anti-tank gun itself, what size was that? What calibre?
That was this, we used to call it the 2-pounder anti-tank gun.
Just a small one?
Yeah. Just like a miniature cannon, you would say. But capabilities were limited, of course. Against a tank, the shell would just bounce off it. It's like throwing a peanut at a pane of glass and expecting the glass to break. Yeah.
Do you recall how many guns made up the platoon?
I think we had four anti-tank guns. And then, of course, there was again with the anti-tank was these Piats, the tool infantry anti-tank.
What were they like? Were they efficient?
There again, they were really worse than the 2-pounder one. I think I'd mentioned in training in England that the Piat Hector was pointed. You had to hit directly at the flat surface to go.
The truck that you were driving in the platoon, yeah, was that the sole ammunition truck that that it had?
No, all the other gun pullers had ammunition on them as well.
But yours was purely supplies in the back?
Yes, yeah. There's a certain amount of ammunition was carried on it. Yeah, the camouflage that as well, of course, the camouflage, the truck.
What size truck was it?
It was a 1500 weight and a Ford V8 engine, I remember that.
Were they efficient trucks?
The trucks themselves, the body wise, the 1500 weight, there was two, the Ford and the Bedford one. Bedford one was more efficient than the Ford V8 one. Bedford was a stripped 6-cylinder engine and it had a greater pulling power than the V8 we found. But as I say, whilst there's ammunition on it, the rear springs of the truck, the bore shape of them was more or less reversed with the weight. Yeah, the truck, as I say, this engine up. On the floor of the truck, you have sandbags, filled sandbags. That was in the event of going over a mine to try and give you a bit of protection to the underneath of your forehead on the pedal truck and that. The windscreen was two small windscreens, one for the driver, one for the passenger, was it. It was just a canvas hood, which had celluloid side windows that would fix into the top of the door, two like spikes going into holes. No, I'm wrong here. And of course, when I tried to set about the door there, there weren't really doors on it. One was a piece of canvas that you would stretch across. So I don't think that truck had windows. What normally the windows in the side of the truck. As I said, just the canvas over, so the elements just blew in between the windshields and the roof. The back of the truck, I should think it would be about, 7 to 8 foot, the carrying area, 7 to 8 foot long, and it would be getting between 5 and 6 foot wide. That was it, and it had sides on it, and a canvas canopy over the top of that, with flaps at the rear end of it, so that you could more or less fasten it all down. The town would sleep in the back of the truck as well. Sleep on the ground.
Was it a reliable engine?
They were pretty reliable, really. I would say the Bedford was a better engine than the Ford, I'm sure. Yeah, as a driver, you weren't allowed to touch it apart from the petrol, oil, and water, and tyres, and that. When you were out of the action, you saved back of the trucks would be inspected, gone over. But I suppose it was like a miniature MOT, as you know, but nowadays, that was it. A lorry would come up at town with petrol on it. Petrol was delivered in four gallon jerry cans. And you didn't use have to sign for the petrol or anything once if you were an active unit. Just came up, you just filled the trucks up until you saw the petrol wagon again. Or oil, carried oil on it as well.
And were you expected to check the petrol, oil and tyres so every day? Was that
daily responsibility, petrol, oil, water and tyres. Imagine that for yours when they have been.
We were talking about the unit itself was near the Volturno. Can we just speak a few minutes about the terrain that you were going through now? Was it flat or hilly or what was it?
Up to that point it was reasonably flat. There was a few odd roads and that which had trees each side of them. And this particular point where we pulled up near this dike, I know there was a row of trees down one side of the road there. As I say, it was pretty flat up to the river, and from there they brought up these canvas boats to go and get across the river at night time and tried to cross. But when they crossed, that was the infantry platoons, naturally we couldn't get across because there were no bridges. The first attack that went in there, they didn't make a success of that. Some of the boats were flat bottom, more or less plywood flat bottoms, with a collapsible canvas sides. The canvas side used to pull them up, and then almost like a stick would go between the top of the canvas and the where there was a piece of wood round it for the frame and the bottom of the boat. Some of them sank, others got blown to bits in the water. At that time, we were more or less in viewing distance of the Volturno itself, which they were going on. We weren't successful, they didn't get across that first attack.
This would be the first time that you were in action. You mentioned the fact that you were shelled and you dived in the ditch. What was your reaction to shelling?
Well, a shell, I don't really imagine it, but wherever it was a shell, you immediately drop down to the ground as flat as you can. And I always remember, even to this day, I can imagine it, that while you were laid on the ground, you would be trying to more or less push your whole body into the ground to get lower and lower. There was that feeling. It's funny, really, because whilst you thought you were pushing yourself in the ground, you weren't really going into it, but you got the impression you were just a bit lower. It would come over and you'd wonder when it was going to stop. You didn't know whether to move or not in case another one came up. But touch wood, I got through them all right. So I was very lucky in that respect.
It must have been a pretty strong feeling of being totally impotent. You couldn't do anything about it. You're just lying there.
Nothing to do. Just even if it was a flat position, actually, if you could see a hole or a in the ground or anything, you would jump into that or get behind it, even a fallen tree if it was available.
If you were in your trucks when shelling came over, did you continue driving or did you stop and get out and find cover?
If the shell were more or less, you took the chance and carried on, try and get through it. Because if you'd stuck, and of course when the German sailors were themselves and that firing, there was always observation posts and they could report back to the cannons that were firing over there. And if you just stood still with the truck, you were a standing target. So, well, it was a gamble, you stand still. I tried to get through it. You do try to get through it. Unless there was a position to drive the truck into. If it was in a approaching a town or outskirts of a farmhouse, you better go and try and get a bit of cover behind that.
The attack across the Volturno, obviously you were not involved because of being on the transport side. Were you in a position that you could, although it was night time, you could basically see what was happening ahead of you?
You could, yes. You couldn't see everything, of course, but you could see. I know when they did go across the second time, when they did manage to get across, not the same day, but a couple of days later, they got over. I remember they were heading, maybe they were only about a platoon, what I could see, but they were heading towards a building. And later, when we caught up with the infantry again, that was after going across the river on the pontoon bridge with them in there. I was talking to one about this building, I could see them going. They said, oh yeah, well, it's a tobacco factory. They got in at one end of it and Jerry was at the other end. I didn't see the Germans come out the other end, but all that's going in from the whole side, going in.
Did you see casualties coming through?
Oh yes, the statue bearers. I used to carry them up, but of course we couldn't bring them all quickly across the river at this time. What boats had got through the second time, we put casualties in and bring them back. Would help to unload the boats and get them to the MO, the medical regimental aid post. There the doctor will see them.